build the kingdom stuff with violence, and the violence shall take it by force. If we can't live in peace, then let's die in peace.
We're all ready to go. If you tell us we have to give our lives now, we're ready. I'm pretty sure all the rest of the brothers are with me.
For months I've tried to keep this thing from happening.
You're going to help yourself and you'll get no help. There's only one hope of glory. That's within you. Nobody's going to come out of the sky. There's no heaven up there. We'll have to make heaven down here.
But only at first. Living, you're looking at death. It only looks to, living is much, much more difficult. Raising up every morning and not knowing what's going to be the night's bringing, it's much more difficult. It's much more difficult. Please, for God's sake, let's get on with it. We've lived as no other people have lived and loved. We've had as much of this world as you're going to get. Let's just be done with it. Let's be done with the agony of it. It's harder to have to watch you every day die slowly, and from the time you were a child to the time you get gray, you're dying. It's honest, and I'm sure that they'll pay for it. They'll pay for it. This is a revolutionary suicide. This is not a self-destructive suicide. So they'll pay for this. They brought this upon us, and they'll pay for that. I leave that destiny to them. I want to go. I want to see you go, though. They can take me and do with me whatever they want to do. I want to see you go. I don't want to see you go through this hell no more. No more, no more, no more. You're trying. So everybody will relax. The best thing you do to relax, and you will have no problem. You'll have no problem with the thing if you just relax. The children here. Let's get calm, let's get calm. To us, we had nothing we could do. We can't separate ourselves from our own people. For 20 years laying in some old rotten nursing home. Taking us through all these anguish years. They took it and put it in chains, and that's nothing. There's no comparison to that, to this. They robbed us of our land, and they've taken us and driven us, and we tried to find ourselves. We tried to find a new beginning, but it's too late. You can't separate yourself from your brother and your sister. No way I'm going to do it. I refuse. I don't know who fired the shot. I don't know who killed the congressman. But as far as I'm concerned, I killed him. With respect, die with a degree of dignity. Lay down your life with dignity. Don't lay down with tears and agony. It's nothing to death. It's like Max said, it's just stepping over in another plane. Don't be this way. Stop this hysterics. This is not the way for people who are socialists and communists to die. No way for us to die. We must die with some dignity. Mother, 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 please. Mother, please, 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 don't do this, don't do this. Lay down your life with your child, but don't do this. Free at last. See, keep your emotions down, keep your emotions down. Children, it will not hurt if you'll be quiet. All over, and it's good. No sorrow that it's all over. I'm glad it's over. Hurry, hurry, my children, hurry. All I say, let's not fall into the hands of the enemy. Hurry, my children. Hurry, the seniors out here that I'm concerned about, hurry. I don't want to leave my seniors to this mess. Quickly, 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 quickly. Sisters. But no, you no more pain, I said, Al. No more pain. Jim Cobb is laying down our life. We're not letting him take our life. We're laying down our life. They're taking their lives. We just want peace. Talking to them, all they're doing is taking a drink to go to sleep. That's what death is, sleep.
But Evan, I'm tired of it all.
Beg you, don't fail to follow my advice. You'll be sorry.
You'll be sorry.
That we do it and that they do it. Us trust you, you have to step across. We used to sing this world's not our home. Well, it sure isn't. That's what we were saying, it sure wasn't. Yeah. He doesn't want to tell him. All he's doing, if they will tell him, assure these children. Can some people assure these children of the relaxation of stepping over to the next plane? We've set an example for others. We've set 1,000 people who say we don't like the way the world is. Take our life from us. We laid it down. We got tired. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world.
The dream was grand. A utopian society free from oppression, racism, and inequality. For Jim Jones and the members of People's Temple, it seemed possible. A sanctuary where everyone was equal, cared for, and safe from the world's injustices. Yet what began as a vision of paradise ended in one of the most horrifying tragedies in modern history. On November 18, 1978, the world witnessed the unthinkable as over 900 men, women, and children perished in a mass murder-suicide in Jonestown, Guyana. This episode unravels the dark transformation of the People's Temple, from its early days as a progressive force for social justice to its descent into manipulation, paranoia, and ultimate devastation. We'll explore the rise of Jonestown as a supposed utopia, the cult-like behaviors that emerged under Jim Jones's authoritarian leadership, and the events that culminated in a day that would shock the world. Through the lens of history and human psychology, we delve into how the line between hope and horror blurred, leaving a lasting scar on the global conscience. This is Scarlet Tavern. All right, so we started this clip off with the speech, the last speech that Jim Jones ever gave. That was 6.5 minutes. That was playing over the loudspeakers in Jonestown while everybody was drinking the Kool-Aid. And you can hear him telling people to calm down and things like that. That's because the Kool-Aid did not work as quickly as he thought it would. People started seizing and bleeding and puking up blood. And so the children started to freak out. And then they were forcing the Kool-Aid down the children's throats. Because the women and children took it first, then the men, then Jim Jones killed himself.
And the whole time this is going on, we're just hearing him talk. Is it him talking, or is it a recording?
No, it's him talking live. He has a microphone, and he's talking live over these loudspeakers. And there's some people that wanted to go, some people that didn't. And you'll see in this that the U.S. government was right there. They were pressing on him, getting ready to pounce, which is why he decided to do this. And again, this is where the term "don't drink the Kool-Aid" comes from, or "they drank the Kool-Aid." That whole thing comes from this. So just keep in mind, as we get towards the end of this and we start talking about Jonestown itself, there are some things in there that are pretty extreme, such as locking people in boxes, things like that. So keep that in mind as we get to there. And the ending, we're talking about how this mass suicide happened. So listener discretion is advised for I mean, honestly, for all of our episodes.
Mm-hmm. If you hear blowing nose and coughing in the background, I am sorry. I am getting over a cold.
So, Jim Jones's dream of Jonestown was rooted in his utopian ideals of equality, communal living, and liberation from the oppression he associated with capitalist America. He envisioned Jonestown as a socialist paradise, a refuge where members of the People's Temple could live free from racial prejudice, economic inequality, and societal judgment. It would be a community built on cooperation, shared resources, and collective purpose. Jones framed Jonestown as the ultimate realization of the principles he had preached for years. It was meant to serve as both a sanctuary for his followers and a shining example of the possibilities of socialism. For many who followed him to the jungles of Guyana, the promise of Jonestown was irresistible. A chance to leave behind the hardships of their previous lives and participate in a grand social experiment. Keep in mind that this is the first of its kind.
Oh, yeah.
You didn't really see communes before this. Obviously, after this, we start seeing more and more and more. Waco, all of that stuff.
I mean, there were communes and stuff like that in the 60s, but not cultic, religious.
Not cultish.
No. It's hippies living in a camp. Or maybe there was a few that were a little bit more organized, but it was not religious. Yeah. It was just peace, love, dope.
And then, of course, from here, then we see Waco and things like that.
Yeah, and I think Jonestown really was like the first religious one. It wasn't the first, because there were other...
The first major.
It's certainly the one that got the most attention, because I think there's another cult that we should cover. I'm going to look it up to double check. It was like in Arkansas. It was a Christian community, not socialism, but it was a legitimate Christian community and run by a pastor and his wife. And it didn't start off as a cult. I mean,
the Alamo Christian Foundation.
I think it might have been that.
Tony Alamo.
Yeah, and his wife.
It was in 1969.
Sounds about right. It was just a Christian community, and they there was really nothing too bad about it, from what I understand.
He died in 2017.
Yeah. But it slowly transformed into like a Jonestown level cult. Just no suicide, because that's not really condoned in the Bible.
Yeah. Jones's choice of Guyana as the location for his utopia was influenced by several factors.
Mm-hmm.
The South American nation's recent independence from British colonial rule aligned with Jones's anti-imperialistic ideals, and its socialist government, led by Prime Minister Forbes Burnham, was receptive to his vision. Guyana's official language of English also made the transition easier for a largely American congregation. Not to mention also... he couldn't be brought back to the United States because at that time, Guyana had no extradition. I believe it does now.
Now it does because
we have relations with Guyana.
It's not a communist nation anymore.
But it had no extradition laws, which means all of the tax fraud and everything he had done in the United States, he could not be brought back from Guyana.
And plus, they were very also closely aligned with the Soviets and the Cuban
and
government.
And he was bringing a lot of money into Guyana.
Well, was he?
Yeah, he did. A lot of his people were rich. Number one, he bought that land. So that was a big thing, too, is he bought the land that he got.
I find that kind of funny that he had private property in a socialist country for a socialist community.
Yeah. Guyana's remote jungle terrain was a double-edged sword. While it provided the seclusion Jones desired to shield the settlement from external scrutiny, it also created a significant logistical challenges. The dense jungle, poor soil, and lack of infrastructure made establishing a self-sufficient community difficult. But Jones believed the isolation was worth the sacrifice to maintain independence from what he called capitalist oppression.
And South America would not be the not the only other cult, Christian cult that showed up there. Colonia Dignidade, Dignity Colony, was a German Christian cult after World War II that was established in Chile, and it actually had the support of General Pinochet, Augusto Pinochet, the dictator of Chile, and he actually would help the cult keep its dissidents. Like, there was a few of them tried to escape, but the Chilean government caught them and just brought them right back.
Jones's charisma and financial resources played a key role in securing the land for Jonestown. He courted Guyanese officials with promises of economic development and international recognition. The People's Temple leased a large plot of land in the northwest region of the country near the border with Venezuela. Officially named the People's Temple Agricultural Project, the settlement was intended to demonstrate the viability of communal socialism. And that's exactly what I was saying. So he promised to bring a better economy into here by figuring out agriculture, which they were lacking at that time.
Thank you, British imperialism, for teaching you.
Obviously, now Guyanese are, it's much better.
Yeah, it's, I don't know, I can't say of how well a country is, but it's not this.
So the first settlers arrived in Guyana in 1974 to begin clearing land and constructing the infrastructure for Jonestown. The initial group, led by Temple member Archie James, worked tirelessly to establish basic facilities, including housing, a power station, and farming areas. The dense jungle posed significant challenges, with settlers battling extreme heat, insects, and limited resources. The initial settlers faced grueling labor conditions, working long hours to transform the jungle into a habitable space. Jones's vision demanded total commitment, with his and his followers responded with enthusiasm, believing they were building a community that would serve as a beacon of hope for the world.
I can just tell you, obviously I've never been to this area, but I do, my habit and hobby is geography. I could tell just from where they send them, Guyana did not give a shit, because this is the most isolated, roughest area of South America. This, I guarantee you, like, yeah, you can have this land, go for it, whatever. Jungle eat you before you know it.
Their early hardships were mitigated by a strong sense of purpose. Jones constantly reinforced the idea that their struggles were noble and necessary, a small price to pay for the realization of their shared dream. Songs, sermons, and communal meals fostered a sense of unity and solidarity among the settlers. By mid-1977, Jones began orchestrating the mass relocation of his followers to Jonestown. His decision to accelerate the migration was driven by increasing scrutiny of the People's Temple in the United States. Negative press, investigations into alleged abuses, and growing dissent among Temple members created a hostile environment for Jones. He saw Jonestown as both a sanctuary and a way to maintain control over his congregation. Jonestown's population surged from approximately 50 settlers in early 1977 to over 900 by the end of the year. The sudden influx overwhelmed the settlement's infrastructure. Housing became overcrowded, food supplies were stretched thin, and the lack of sanitation posed health risks. The dream of self-sufficiency proved elusive, as the settlement relied heavily on supplies imported from the United States.
We must escape capitalism of America, but we have to buy everything from America.
Yes. Jones portrayed Jonestown as a thriving success to those still in the United States, encouraging more members to join. Letters, newsletters, and photographs sent back to America emphasized the community's achievements, showing smiling residents and bountiful crops. These images concealed the growing difficulties within the settlement. Despite Jones's lofty goals, the practical realities of running a remote agricultural commune proved daunting. The soil in the region was poor, and crops often failed. This forced the community to rely on imported staples like rice and beans, straining their financial resources. Residents worked tirelessly to improve the settlement, but progress was slow and physically demanding. Jonestown's agricultural operations required backbreaking labor. Residents cleared land, planted crops, and tended to livestock with rudimentary tools. The harsh conditions and long workdays left many physically and emotionally exhausted. With over 900 mouths to feed, the settlement struggled to provide adequate nutrition. Meals were simple and repetitive, typically consisting of rice, beans, and occasional vegetables. Protein sources like meat or eggs were rare, and malnutrition became a serious issue, particularly for children and the elderly. I will preface that by saying protein sources like meat and eggs were given to Jim Jones. He was the one that ate the good meals.
Like a king?
Yes. He was eating all the proteins. He was eating good meals. He never had malnutrition.
You could really tell that with like the pictures I've seen. Like he
ain't a skinny boy.
He's not. But where you see all these other people, they're skinny.
Yeah.
I mean, they look at him just, it's all, I mean, it's a special, it's a name for a type of starvation. But basically, he's starving them to look. It's like, look, he's so well fed. He's healthy. He must be anointed by God or whatever. And they just cling to him more, partially because the hunger is probably driving them to do it too.
Yeah. As Jonestown grew, so did Jones's grip on the community. His vision of a socialist paradise demanded absolute loyalty and discipline, and he used both ideological rhetoric and fear to maintain control. Jones referred to Jonestown as the purest expression of socialism, calling its residents the vanguard of the revolution. He preached that their sacrifices were necessary to demonstrate the superiority of their way of life. This messaging reinforced collective solidarity, but also justified the harsh conditions. And that superiority definitely comes from his beliefs in those amazing leaders he read early on.
Totally not problematic people.
Yeah. Jones implemented strict rules to ensure compliance with his vision. Letters to family members in the U.S. were censored, and residents were forbidden from speaking negatively about the settlement. Armed guards patrolled the perimeter, and residents were encouraged to report on one another's behavior. This created an atmosphere of mistrust and paranoia.
I mean, the armed guards were kind of redundant. I mean, again, this is one of the most remote areas on Earth. Run into the jungle 20 feet, you're lost.
Oh, just wait until the White Knight or the White Knights, which we're about to talk about.
A little bit more than that.
What do you mean?
They knew those jungles inside and out. If you live there long enough.
Yeah, but
they didn't live there long enough. These people from Indiana. They don't know. They didn't know about the Amazon jungle.
Dissenters face public punishments, reduced food rations, or isolation in the box, a small wooden enclosure used for solitary confinement. Jones also conducted loyalty tests where he fabricated threats to the community and observed how residents responded. These tactics reinforced his authority and quelled dissent. So, again, this is the box I was telling about. So, this box wasn't isolated. This box was in the middle of the compound, like on the stage where he did his speeches. The box was there. It had, I believe it had lattice on the side so you could see in and you could see out. And you were put in there and you were locked, like a lock was put on it. And Jones was the only one with the lock. And it was guarded at all times.
I mean, I can definitely tell probably a lot of the people in the congregation did time in the South, because this is how the Southern penal system was. I mean, if anybody's ever seen the movie Cool Hand Luke with Paul Newman, great movie, you should watch it. That's it, the box. He's like, you spend a night in the box. Literally, you just lock him in this wood box for a day, couple days, a week, and that's your punishment.
Can you guess what the loyalty tests were?
The Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
It was. So he would tell them all the time, way long before he did the poisoning, he would tell them all the time that the Kool-Aid had poison in it and he wanted them to drink it. And that was the loyalty test. And if you failed, you went in the box. But most of them actually drank it. As life in Jonestown became more challenging, Jones's behavior grew increasingly erratic. He was plagued by paranoia, believing that external forces, particularly the U.S. government, were conspiring to destroy the settlement. His speeches became darker and more apocalyptic, warning residents of imminent attacks and urging them to remain vigilant. Jones began holding quote-unquote white knights, N-I-G-H-T-S, emergency drills where residents practiced responding to hypothetical attacks. During these drills, Jones sometimes instructed followers to drink liquid he claimed was poison, framing it as a rehearsal for revolutionary suicide. Though the liquid was harmless, these events conditioned residents to accept the idea of mass death as a form of resistance. And I will say, the way these white knight drills worked is he would send his own guards out into the jungle and they would fire rounds off randomly.
Just to simulate, to be like, oh no, the government's here to take us.
And he wouldn't tell them ahead of time. He would go, and then he would get over. We're being under attack, blah, 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 and do the whole simulation. And then at the end, he would go, all right, this was a white knight drill. Yeah. By late 1978, the cracks in Jonestown's foundation were becoming impossible to ignore. The settlement was overpopulated, under-resourced, and deeply controlled by Jones's authoritarian leadership. Many residents felt trapped, unable to leave due to their isolation and fear of retribution. What had been envisioned as a socialist paradise was, in reality, a community on the brink of collapse, held together by fear, manipulation, and the unrelenting belief that their sacrifices were part of a greater cause. The seeds of tragedy were firmly planted, and it was only a matter of time before the dreams of Jonestown was unraveled completely. Jonestown's creation was a testament to Jim Jones's charisma and the power of collective idealism. Yet the settlement's challenges and Jones's increasing authoritarianism turned what was supposed to be a utopia into a dystopia. The harsh realities of life in Jonestown set the stage for the devastating events that would bring the dream to an end. So, we're going to start getting into the daily life on what they were dealing with, and you can only imagine what it was. So for those who initially arrived in Jonestown, the settlement was a symbol of hope and a chance to escape the struggles of life in the United States. Jim Jones had promised his followers a socialist paradise where they could live free from racism, capitalism, and social inequality. The early settlers were inspired by the vision of building a utopia from the ground up, a place where everyone worked together for the collective good. Upon arrival, residents were greeted with a sense of community and purpose. The natural beauty of the surrounding jungle provided a stark contrast to the oppressive urban environments many had left behind. Jones emphasized the importance of communal effort, urging his followers to see themselves as pioneers of a revolutionary new way of life. As Jonestown grew, however, the idealism began to clash with the harsh realities of life in the jungle. What had been portrayed as a thriving commune was, in truth, an isolated and under-resourced settlement struggling to meet the ends of its growing population. Work in Jonestown was relentless. Residents toiled from sunrise to sunset, clearing land, planting crops, and constructing buildings. The jungle terrain was unforgiving, with dense vegetation, poor soil, and oppressive heat, making even the simplest tasks arduous. Many settlers were unaccustomed to such labor, leading to physical exhaustion and frequent injuries. Jonestown's remote location was location of poor agriculture conditions made self-sufficiency nearly impossible. Despite Jones's claims that the community could sustain itself, the settlement relied heavily on imported supplies, including food, medical equipment, and construction materials. Meals were monotonous and meager, often consisting of rice, beans, and occasional vegetables. Protein sources such as meat or eggs were rare and reserved for Jones and his inner circle.
I never understood, with all everything we've seen, as much as welcoming as the Guyana government, you would have thought they would have at least helped a little bit. Like, send some construction crews down, do something. I mean, they seem they're both socialists.
But the thing is, do we know that they didn't offer? And Jim Jones is like, no, I don't want any help.
He wouldn't have turned that down.
Yeah, I was about to say. I mean,
not from another socialist.
Exactly. Government. I mean, I don't.
From the U.S., yes, but a socialist government, no.
I can't help but wonder if this really was a mutual respecting, or just the Guyanese government was just like, yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Probably it was just, yeah, whatever. Don't care. You're giving us money. So why should we? We don't care.
Jones has gotten into a lot of financial trouble back in the United States. You think he would have used some of that money to buy some construction equipment to clear the land?
Yeah.
But it also depends. The construction equipment is expensive as fuck.
And I'm sure, given the location of this place,
this is the 70s. It's not that expensive.
No.
And everything was made out of wood. It's not like they're building concrete and all of that. So, with over 900 residents, Jonestown quickly became overcrowded. Housing was sparse, and many families were crammed into small cabins or communal dormitories. Privacy was virtually non-existent, and the lack of proper sanitation facilities exacerbated health issues. And I believe there is... Let me see if I can find it.
What are you looking for?
Yeah, there it is. So, like, this is some of the housing in Jonestown.
Yeah, it's very Spartan, the Huttons in San Antonio that we all trained in were more luxurious than that.
Very much so.
I hated those things.
Everybody did.
They were just...
Actually, I was in horrible. The dorm.
I mean, I...
Guys were in the Huttons and the girls were in the dorms.
Am I the only one who had to suffer in that wooden hellhole box?
And then in tech school, I had the firehouse.
I hate you both.
I had G-Bay.
You had jailhouse, didn't you?
Yeah, I had jailhouse.
I had G-Bay.
Doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, I know it doesn't. Thank God, because it was...
I had G-Bay.
Firehouse got redone, too.
I got bronchitis because of the mole in that.
I don't believe G-Bay exists anymore.
I don't think it does either.
G-Bay's gone?
Yeah.
I was trying not to say that.
Why? We're not censored here.
Yeah, I believe that's gone now.
Probably. I'm the only one here who experienced the Huttons. For all of those you don't know, who's any security forces members from
security forces, you know exactly what we're talking about.
Yeah, the Huttons are just basically exactly what they sound. They're these just smallish wooden houses that fit about.
Yeah, they redid it. That's firehouse now.
God, it looks like a resort.
It looks better than when I was there. Ours was good, although the cameras didn't work.
Yeah, they're just basically a wooden little house, mini house, fits six people, three on each side. That's what the Huttons are. But it's in the middle of Texas Hill Country. It can't pull us. It's hot. It's uncomfortable, and the bathrooms were unsanitary and roach infested.
I mean, that was.
Anything. See, our issue with the dorms is they got way too cold. The AC would blow way too hard.
Oh, see, I didn't have that issue.
Although now they have like a full fucking like.
I wouldn't be surprised if that thing had looked at the picture. Doesn't have a full spa and.
It does have a. It has a. Like a mini market in it now, from what I heard.
What?
I hate
that you can go in there and you don't have to go all the way. Yeah.
Granted, the DFAC was okay.
Well, it's not even a DFAC. It's
if you have a midnight snack or something.
Yeah, you go right in there, you open it with your CAC and go in there and buy. Shaving stuff, all of that.
Like, I understand the practicality.
You don't have to go all the way across to the other side. Because that is a long walk.
Eh, whatever.
It's a long walk.
It's character building.
I mean, I almost got bit by a baby copperhead, and I had to sprint across the field between G-Bay and...
Really redid it. That's the inside.
Like I said.
Between G and F-Bay to the firehouse, because we weren't sure where Mama Copperhead was.
Like I said. It's character building.
No.
Sorry for those of you that are going into security forces. You have it a lot easier.
You really do.
Because, like I said, jailhouse is gone. I believe G-Bay is gone. And G-Bay was the worst between G-Bay and Firehouse. And for those that are going into it, it's called Firehouse because it caught on fire. It's literally not
They don't a tell you that.
It caught on fire at one point. But anyways.
Back to the cult that killed themselves.
Yes. I mean, okay, so the U.S. Air Force.
I mean, we all know that the military is a cult.
No, the Marine Corps is a cult.
No, the military is a cult.
The military is a cult.
Yeah, I guess it is.
The Marine Corps is just the cultier of the cult.
People, what is the definition of a cult? A group of people with the same mindset following a leader without questioning orders.
Yeah, no, I get it.
And typically all living in a community.
So does that mean veterans can all apply for, you know, cult survival benefits or something?
Yes. Children made up a significant portion of Jonestown's population. Jones presented them as the embodiment of the community's future. Education was a priority, but it was heavily influenced by Jones's ideology. Lessons focused on socialism, racial equality, and Jones's teaching, while traditional subjects were often neglected. He didn't teach them math and English. This was all social stuff.
So nothing that's useful.
Correct.
I mean, he intended these people to live in the jungle forever.
Yeah.
What do they need math and English for?
Jones used the classroom as a platform to reinforce loyalty to him and the ideals of Jonestown. Teachers integrated propaganda into their lessons, framing Jones as a benevolent leader of the settlement as a utopian model. Children were taught to reject capitalist views and view Jones as a savior figure. Despite Jones's rhetoric about protecting children, they were among the most vulnerable members of the community. Malnutrition and illness were common, and children were subjected to the same strict rules and punishment as adults. In some cases, they were used as pawns to manipulate their parents, with Jones threatening to separate families or harm children to enforce compliance. He would put children into the box. Like, young children would go into the box. I've seen a video where there's a video that you can find. I don't think it's a child in the box, but there's a video of him putting somebody in the box.
Please don't ever show that to me. That first audio clip was disturbing enough, hearing the children screaming.
Yeah. Life in Jonestown was marked by an atmosphere of constant surveillance and control. Jones had created a system in which every aspect of daily life was monitored and regulated, ensuring that dissent was quickly identified and suppressed. Jonestown was surrounded by armed guards who patrolled the perimeter and monitored the residents. These guards, loyal to Jones, acted as enforcers, ensuring that no one attempted to leave the settlement without permission. The threat of punishment created a climate of fear that discouraged rebellion. Jones encouraged residents to report to one another, fostering suspicion and paranoia within the community. Even casual complaints or expressions of dissatisfaction could result in public reprimands, reduced rations, or physical punishment. The system of informants allowed Jones to maintain control and isolate potential deserters. And this, dissenters. This is 101. This is a lot of people believe, and when we redo our thing on MK Ultra, a lot of people believe Jones was.
Are we redoing MK Ultra?
I believe so. I don't know. But if not, go back and listen to our MK Ultra.
I don't think we are.
It's a good.
That was season two.
But a lot of people believe, and I believe we talked about it in MK Ultra, that Jim Jones was involved in MK Ultra, that he was one of the people that was influenced by MK Ultra.
When I did a lot of the research for that, I did a lot of that is strictly in the realm of speculation. I think a lot of people who delve deeply into Jonestown tried to just find a reason of why one man was able to manipulate close to 1,000 people to just basically kill themselves. And I think the sad fact of the matter was, and again, I'll go over the research again. And what
I think you're right. I think that people, especially during that time, were trying to figure out why they would do it.
Exactly. And I think the sad truth of it was, is just that a very charismatic man was able to manipulate.
But it doesn't mean that we don't know if he was involved or not.
And like you said, I'll go over my research again, but I think a lot of it was firmly conspiracy theory. Jones was a part of MK Ultra, and this was all in the massacre and the suicide. It was,
because I did some of that research too.
Well, here's an article, July 15th, 1980. This is the Washington Afro-American newspaper that went around D.C. A top aide to the late Congressman Leo J. Ryan, who was killed in 1978 when he went to Guyana in, to investigate the Reverend Jim Jones and his people's temple. Religious movement has discounted as mythology that more than 900 followers of Jones, most of whom were black, voluntarily committed suicide on order of the charismatic leader. In an interview with Washington Afro-American last week, Joe Holsinger, Ryan's chief administrative assistant, outlined information which he says indicates the existence of a covert CIA operation in Guyana that had not been reported to congressional oversight committees. Further, Holsinger said he now believes in the horrifying possibility that Jonestown was part of a mass mind control experiment by the CIA as part of its MKUltra program, which was supposedly terminated in the early 1970s. And we know what MKUltra is. They said that, but instead of terminating the MKUltra program, Holsinger said the CIA simply shifted its programs from public institutions to private organizations. Experimentation into mind control was previously done in federal and state penitentiaries and in some government-run hospitals. Holsinger has been pressuring for a congressional investigation of the CIA involvement in settlement with the settlement, believes that Ryan's visit to the ill-fated colony may have pierced the veil of secrecy surrounding alleged CIA activities there and would have eventually exposed them.
Again, sounds... The only information we really, it seems like, yeah, is firmly rooted in conspiracy. One guy who was supposedly, who talked to an aide of a congressman and possibly this and that. A lot of leaps of faith.
So, Jonestown, or Jones, used the public address system to broadcast sermons and speeches throughout the day, reinforcing his authority and warning of external threats. He painted the U.S. government as an enemy intent on destroying Jonestown, a narrative that deepened residents' dependence on him for protection. Jones maintained discipline through public punishments and psychological manipulation, ensuring that his authority went unchallenged. Residents who disobeyed rules or questioned Jones's authority faced harsh consequences, public beatings, confinement in the box, a small wooden enclosure used for solitary punishment, and even forced drugging were common methods of discipline. These punishments served as both a deterrent and a demonstration of Jones's power. And again, Jones frequently staged white knight emergency drills in which residents were told they were under attack by external enemies. During these drills, residents gathered in the central pavilion to await instructions. Jones sometimes distributed a liquid he claimed was poisoned, demanding that residents drink it as a test of their loyalty. Although the liquid was harmless, the drills conditioned residents to accept the idea of mass suicide as a potential response to external threats. As Jonestown faced increasing challenges, Jones's behavior became increasingly erratic. His health was declining, partly due to his heavy use of drugs, including amphetamines, barbiturates, and tranquilizers. He often appeared disoriented and incoherent during his speeches, further alarming the residents.
Surprised he was able to even make the speeches when he's hopped up on all that shit.
Oh, yeah. Jones became obsessed with the idea that Jonestown was under imminent threat from the U.S. government, defectors, and even the Guyanese authorities. He frequently warned residents of impending attacks, using fear to justify his authoritarian rule and the harsh conditions of life in Jonestown. Jones's paranoia extended to his inner circle as he began suspecting even his closest aides of betrayal. His isolation and reliance on loyalists who reinforced his delusions further distorted his perception of reality. This detachment from the outside world contributed to the escalating instability within Jonestown. Despite the difficulties, there were moments when residents found solace in their shared purpose. Communal meals, songs, and celebrations helped maintain morale, and many members still believed in the dreams of Jonestown. These moments of unity reinforce the idea that their sacrifices were meaningful and necessary. For many residents, the hardships of Jonestown were seen as a temporary challenge that could be overcome through collective effort. The belief in a brighter future and a sense of belonging within the community sustained them, even as conditions worsened. And listen, a community that can self-sustain itself and be uplifting and work together, that's great. Mm-hmm. I firmly believe in that. I firmly believe we should be able to rely on ourselves and nobody else. Should we do it this way? Mm-hmm. Absolutely not. But
I'm telling you, if we ever get property, if you put up speakers so I have to hear you every freaking day, I will burn everything down.
Don't worry, we can hide an Alexa randomly throughout the house.
And all I hear is, exercise, exercise, exercise.
I'll drink the Kool-Aid at that point.
No, you won't.
Oh, yes, I will. To get away from that sound, any veteran, especially the ones in the Air Force, will understand my...
Exercise.
I'm gonna have fucking nightmares tonight.
No, it's the red light shining in your face like, hey, you have fire watch.
And that too. Ugh. Let's see here. Okay. So by late 1978, the cracks in Jonestown's facade had become increasingly visible. While Jones continued to portray the settlement as a model of success, the reality was one of overwork, malnutrition, and fear. Many residents began to question their decision to move to Jonestown, but leaving was nearly impossible due to the settlement's isolation and Jones's strict control. Keep in mind that where they lived, you had a helicopter basically in and out.
Well, they were near an airport. Like, there's an airport that was like fairly down the road, so... It's still a nice area, but that really was kind of the only efficient
way. We'll see when the senator, the congressman comes in. He comes in by helicopter.
I thought it was airplane.
It's helicopter. He gets shot on the helicopter.
No, he gets shot on the airplane because he had to delay a day because so many people wanted to come with him. So that's why he went and got an airplane to land there. So then he could take all the people that wanted to leave.
Defectors and dissenters began to voice their concerns more openly, though often at great personal risk. These individuals would later play a crucial role in exposing the truth about Jonestown to the outside world. Their courage in the face of immense pressure highlighted the strength of the human spirit, even in the darkest of circumstances. Life in Jonestown was a study in contrast, a community built on ideals of equality and unity that devolved into a dystopia of control and fear. For many residents, the dream of a socialist paradise remained alive, even as the reality became increasingly grim. The tension between hope and disillusionment would come to a head in the tragic events that followed, revealing the full extent of Jones's manipulation and the fragility of the utopian dream he had promised. And for those of you that want a socialist government, think about this when you think about socialism.
Yeah.
Because this is where it leads. So, speaking of Congressman Leo Ryan, the arrival of Congressman Leo Ryan at Jonestown in November 1978 was a pivotal moment in the story of the People's Temple. Ryan, a California Democrat, was known for his hands-on approach to investigating allegations of abuse and misconduct, and he would go everywhere, wherever he needed to.
From what I remember, just very little I've ever looked up about Congressman Ryan, he was a go-getter. He wasn't like one of those limousine liberals who would just write a check for things and just kind of forget about it. He was a very like hands-on community person.
Yeah. After hearing complaints from the concerned relatives, a group of former temple members and family members of current residents, Ryan decided to personally visit Jonestown to assess the situation. Reports of human rights abuses, coercion, and the confiscation of passports had reached Ryan's office, fueling concerns about the well-being of Jonestown residents. Now, you may think, okay, they're in Guyana, he can't do anything. These people are United States residents. They're United States people. They did not denounce their citizenship from the United States. Mm-hmm. So he has every right to go there and help them defect back, because at this point, if Guyana doesn't help, they are harboring U.S. citizens illegally.
I mean, exactly. And unfortunately, just normal laws, if Jones has taken their passports, the Guyanese can't really do anything.
Yeah.
They can't, all they can do is just arrest them, but then they can't deport them to the U.S. Yeah. because technically they have no way of verifying, are you Americans? I have no idea.
Yeah. So, yeah, they, with this, Ryan's basically seeing what's going on, if these are U.S. citizens, all of that stuff, to be able to then go, hey, this is it. We're bringing all these people back. All these, their families want them back. They're coming back. They are U.S. citizens. You can't hold them here. The Concerned Relatives group had been relentless in their efforts to bring attention to the plight of their loved ones in Jonestown. They alleged that Jones was holding members against their will, using manipulation, threats, and violence to maintain control.
Spoiler alert, he was doing it.
They provided Ryan with affidavits and testimonies from defectors, as well as letters from residents pleading for help. That one is a little iffy because the letters were screened. So Jones would never have let those letters go out. So it's, I highly doubt there were letters from people that were inside.
Yeah, unless they had like a game of like coming up with cryptic like words there, and
these
stuff.
These people aren't that smart. And Jones would have figured that out.
Yeah.
Well, you never know. He was high on drugs all the time.
But he was paranoid.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And you got to understand, he has people from all walks of life in this.
He has some smart people. I can definitely tell you the way he set it up. He either had a lot of ex-cons in there, or he had former CEOs, because this looks, I mean, obviously it's prison, but the way everything is set up, this is a legit prison. Like, this is somebody from, like, down south worked or served time in a southern prison, and he set it up just perfectly. The box, or the hard labor.
Or knew someone that did.
Or maybe they just watched Cool Hand Luke a few too many times and just kind of used that as a training manual.
The growing media scrutiny of Jonestown also added pressure on Ryan to take action. Journalists from major outlets had begun investigating the People's Temple, uncovering troubling details about its operations both in the United States and in Guyana. Ryan's decision to travel to Jonestown marked an unprecedented step in holding Jones accountable, as it was rare for a sitting congressman to undertake such a dangerous mission. And again, keep in mind, he is a United States congressman flying into Guyana, which at this point was
unheard of.
It was unstable. Guyana at this point was very unstable.
So he like literally is like, well,
this. It, I mean, obviously we know it cost him his life, but not by Guyana.
So right after independence, Guyana started already getting into spats with Venezuela. Venezuelan troops had already, on a number of times, had already gone into Guyana for territorial disputes. I'm actually shocked that they actually put them near there, or they went there. Just, again, highlighting that they didn't give a shit, because up until a few years before the massacre of 1978, Venezuela was invading that area. This was being occupied by Venezuelan soldiers. So yeah. This is not a very stable, even this is an unstable region in an unstable country.
Ryan did not travel alone. His delegation included several members of the Concerned Relatives group, staff members, journalists from NBC and other outlets, and U.S. Embassy officials. The group flew to Georgetown, the capital of Guyana, on November 15, 1978, and spent 2 days coordinating with the Guyanese authorities before making their way to Jonestown. Jones had been informed of Ryan's impending visit and was deeply paranoid about the potential consequences. He viewed Ryan as a direct threat to his authority and feared that the congressman would expose Jonestown's darker realities.
Which it did.
In Georgetown, Temple members loyal to Jones attempted to obstruct the delegation's progress. Some members of the concerned relatives were followed and harassed, and Temple attorneys tried to convince Ryan to abandon the visit. On November 17th, Ryan and his delegation boarded a small plane to Port Kaituma, the airstrip nearest to Jonestown. From there, they traveled by truck along rough jungle roads to the settlement. The journey itself underscored the remote and isolated nature of Jonestown, which had been carefully chosen by Jones to discourage outside interference. When Ryan and his delegation arrived, they were met with a carefully orchestrated welcome. Jones and his followers had prepared for the visit, creating a facade of harmony and happiness to present to the congressman and the journalists. Residents were coached to appear cheerful and content, and the settlement was tidied up to give the impression of a well-functioning community. Members were instructed to praise Jones and emphasize the positive aspects of life in Jonestown. Children were seen playing, communal meals were served, and the residents sang songs of unity and socialism.
Guarantee you, they ate well, Ryan. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, they did. People say that it was the best that they had ever eaten.
Usually is before you die.
Despite the outward appearance of happiness, tensions simmered beneath the surface. Some residents saw Ryan's visit as an opportunity to escape, while others feared retaliation if they spoke out. Jones himself appeared uneasy, his usual commanding presence overshadowed by paranoia and anxiety. His speeches during the visit were rambling and defensive, filled with warnings about the dangers of the outside world. So, a lot of people saw, when they saw Ryan, they kept up the appearances, but they were whispering to him in secret. They were talking to him in secret, saying, hey, this is what's really going on. We're scared. Get us out of here.
The whole food, like eating well before you die. Jones didn't plan on, the only reason why the mass suicide happened as early as it did, I'm not saying that it wouldn't happen. The reason it happened as early as it did is because Ryan was killed.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We're about to get into.
On the evening of November 17th, the delegation was treated to a performance by the Jonestown residents showcasing music, dance, and testimonials about the success of the community. However, cracks in the facade began to emerge. During the visit, Temple member Vernon Gosney slipped a note to NBC journalist Don Harris, which I believe Don Harris is dead now, but at that time they were a decent journalist. The note read, "Please help me get out of Jonestown," and included the name of another member, Monica Bagby, who also wished to leave. This act of defiance marked a turning point, confirming suspicions that not all residents were there by choice.
Don Harris, yes, he was an unfortunate victim.
Yes, that's right. He got, yeah. As news of the defection spread within the settlement, more residents came forward to express their desire to leave. Some approached Ryan directly, while others quietly informed members of the delegation. By the morning of November 18th, Ryan had compiled a list of around 15 individuals who had wished to return to the United States with him. Jones attempted to downplay the defections, insisting that the residents were free to leave if they wished. However, his demeanor grew increasingly agitated as the number of defectors grew. He didn't just go, okay, they can go. He made a whole speech. We have defectors. These 15 want to leave. That's fine. They're allowed to leave if they want. And the people were like, oh, we're allowed to leave? Okay. Hands went up, and it doubled and tripled. He warned his followers of the consequences of betraying the community, suggesting that those who left would face hostility and discrimination in the outside world. As Ryan and his delegation prepared to leave Jonestown on the afternoon of November 18th, the atmosphere in the settlement grew increasingly tense. Jones's inner circle scrambled to maintain control, and armed guards were seen gathering near the pavilion. Before departing, Ryan narrowly avoided an attack by Temple member Don Sly, who lunged at him with a knife. The incident underscored the volatile situation and reinforced the delegation's decision to leave as quickly as possible. Ryan and his group, including the defectors, boarded trucks to return to Port Kaituma airstrip. The journey was fraught with tension as many feared retaliation from Jones's guards. The sense of relief upon reaching the airstrip was short-lived as events quickly took a violent turn.
Now, which is interesting about was the massacre is that despite Congressman Ryan taking these defectors back with him, his initial report, he bought into it. He saw the happy people singing, dancing, and everything. He was like...
He just thought that these people just wanted to go.
Yeah, he's like, well, I mean, we have some people want to go, but everyone seems pretty good here. Great. Yeah,
he wasn't
going to do it. Jones was the one who's like, no, we're doomed. And even some people who survived the massacre heard Jones saying, we're doomed. But even people saying, like, Reverend, we're not doomed. He's saying that we're fine. He's like, well, we're doomed. I think at this point, whatever little grasp of reality Jones had just broke.
As the group prepared to board their planes, a truck carrying armed members of Jones's security force arrived at the airstrip. Without warning, the guards opened fire on the delegation. The gunmen targeted both the larger Twin Otter plane and smaller Cessna, firing indiscriminately at the passengers and crew. NBC cameraman Bob Brown managed to capture the first moments of the attack on film before being killed. Congressman Ryan, journalists Don Harris and Greg Robinson, and Temple defector Patricia Parks were also killed in the assault.
I believe there is a still, so you can go on YouTube, you can still see the video of the Jonestown guard showing up and opening fire.
Several members of the delegation survived the attack, either by fleeing into the jungle or by hiding among the bodies. Future Congresswoman Jackie Speier, a member of Ryan's staff, shot multiple times but managed to survive by playing dead. Survivors eventually made their way to safety and alerted authorities to the massacre. And again, she would go on to come home, survive, and become a congresswoman. The airstrip attack sealed the fate of Jonestown. Jones received word of the massacre and concluded that the settlement could no longer survive. He called an emergency meeting in the central pavilion where he informed his followers that they were now under attack and that their only option was revolutionary suicide. Jones's rhetoric during the meeting was filled with despair and justification. He portrayed the deaths at the airstrip as evidence of the world's hostility towards Jonestown, framing the community's impending mass suicide as an act of defiance rather than surrender. With the deaths of Ryan and the others at the airstrip, the stage was set for the final tragic chapter of Jonestown. The events of November 18 would become one of the most devastating and haunting episodes in modern history, a grim testament to the dangers of unchecked power and ideological fanaticism. Congressman Leo Ryan's visit to Jonestown was a moment of hope for many residents, but ultimately ended in tragedy. His efforts to investigate the settlement and advocate for its residents were met with violence and betrayal, underscoring the extent of Jim Jones's control and paranoia. The airstrip attack not only claimed Ryan's life, but also set in motion the events that would lead to the mass deaths in Jonestown later that same day. The courage of Ryan and his delegation remains a powerful reminder of the importance of standing up to authoritarianism, even in the face of overwhelming danger.
And funny enough, Congresswoman Speier, actually, not too long ago, she was still serving in Congress. She decided not to run for Congress in 2022.
The tragedy at Jonestown on November 18, 1978, was the culmination of Jim Jones's escalating paranoia and the psychological control he exerted over his followers. After receiving word that the airstrip attack had failed to eliminate all of Congressman Leo Ryan's delegation, Jones gathered the residents of Jonestown in the Central Pavilion. He declared that the outside world was coming for them and that their only escape was through revolutionary suicide. The pavilion, the heart of Jonestown, was a large open-air structure where residents had gathered daily for Jones's sermons and communal meetings. On this day, it became the site of one of the most devastating mass deaths in modern history. Armed guards surrounded the pavilion, making it clear that residents that leaving was not an option. Jones addressed his followers with a mixture of fear, persuasion, and coercion. He claimed that Congressman Ryan's death would bring retribution from the U.S. government, and that Jonestown would soon be invaded by hostile forces. Framing their deaths as a political statement, he argued that suicide was an act of protest against oppression and a way to preserve the community's ideals. Jones's voice, recorded on what is now known as the death tape, which we just played at the beginning of this, alternated between soothing reassurances and frantic urgency. He urged his followers to see death as a peaceful transition and described it as stepping over into another plane. The method of mass deaths was meticulously planned. Over the years, Jones had stockpiled cyanide under the guise of needing it to purify gold. And he had conducted rehearsals of mass suicide during the infamous White Knights drills. On this day, the poison was mixed with grape-flavored Flavor Aid, along with sedatives and other drugs, and placed in a large metal tub, because he couldn't afford Kool-Aid.
Yeah, he used, I think they said he used Kool-Aid for the White Knight drills, but when it actually, like, okay, now we're actually doing it, he used Flavor Aid. In the end, he cheaped out.
Yeah. The first to die were the children. Parents and caregivers used syringes to squirt the poison drink into the mouths of infants and young children. Witnesses reported that the children cried and convulsed as the poison took effect. Watching their children die was a traumatic and devastating moment for many parents, but Jones's guards ensured that resistance was futile.
What, were they bored or something?
Yes. Adults were instructed to line up and drink the poison in an orderly fashion. Those who hesitated were coerced by armed guards who presented a grim choice: drink willingly or face execution by gunfire. Some residents reportedly tried to escape but were quickly apprehended. For those who refused to drink, the poison was forcibly injected. Survivors recounted seeing guards holding down dissenters while syringes filled with cyanide were plunged into their skin. Jesus. The overwhelming presence of armed security left little room for resistance or escape. As the deaths unfolded, the scene in the pavilion descended into chaos. Children's cries filled the air, mingling with the sobs of parents and the shouting of Jones and his loyalists. Many residents appeared resigned to their fate, their spirits broken by years of psychological manipulation and isolation. Jones's armed guards played a dual role, both enforcing compliance and participating in the suicide themselves. Some guards drank the poison after ensuring the others had done so, while others reportedly shot themselves or were shot by fellow loyalists. The guards' presence ensured that the mass suicide unfolded as Jones intended, with minimal resistance. Jones himself remained seated on a chair near the stage where watching the deaths unfold. He continued to speak over the public address system, urging his followers to embrace death as an act of defiance and loyalty. His voice grew weaker and more erratic as the poison took its toll on the community. And it was a wicker chair that he would sit in, almost like a rocking chair. And that's where he would do his speeches from, too. Hmm. And he would just sit there at the edge, and he would just sit there and watch.
Probably because
they're all screaming and dying. And if I remember right, he had like a headset that he would talk into. And that's how he talked over the speaker. The deaths occurred quickly, but not without suffering. Cyanide poisoning causes excruciating symptoms, including convulsions, foaming at the mouth, and intense pain. The pavilion became a scene of horror as bodies began to pile up in concentric circles around a central stage. One of the most poignant moments on the death tape is the voice of Christine Miller, a temple member who openly challenged Jones during the meeting. She argued against suicide, questioning why they couldn't seek refuge in another country or negotiate with the U.S. government. Jones dismissed her objections, and his guards silenced her. Miller's dissent highlights the internal conflict faced by some residents, even in their final moments. Jim Jones did not drink the poison. Instead, he was found with a gunshot wound to the head, lying on the ground near his chair.
Of course he didn't. He saw how much everybody else was suffering. He's like, oh, fuck that.
He never planned on drinking.
He was never going to suffer like that.
It remains unclear whether he shot himself or he was killed by a loyal follower, but his death marked the end of his control over the community, but left a legacy of unimaginable devastation. I believe he was killed by another follower, because I don't think he has the balls to kill himself.
Yeah, I think
that's probably true.
Plus, there was no gun by him.
Oh, there wasn't?
No, they never found a gun by him.
Okay.
It was just his body.
Because I could see him being the last one there.
He was the last one. Technically.
Well, I mean, everyone's dead or is escaped. Yeah,
from what I believe, it was bang, bang. And it was a murder-suicide.
I wonder which one did it.
I don't know. But despite the overwhelming death toll, a small number of residents survived the massacre. Their stories provide crucial insights into the final hours of Jonestown. Some survivors managed to flee into the surrounding jungle as the deaths began. They hid among the dense vegetation, waiting until the following day to emergency seek help. These individuals recounted the terror of hearing gunshots and the cries of those left behind. They're lucky they didn't get eaten by jaguars.
Yeah, because I remember correctly. Yes, a majority of the people were at the pavilion, but again, everybody is still there's not even people. There are other people going around doing the regular activities and chores of there. They were
rounding people up.
I read one account of he was actually the cousin of Huey Newton. Anyone knows Huey Newton? He was a prominent Black Power type of dude. He was his cousin. He was there where he worked in the kitchen of Jonestown. And when everyone was getting rounded up or starting to kill himself, he just kind of opened the window and he just kind of whoop, like dipped out into the jungle.
A lot of people probably did, like the survivors, is because that's a ton of confusion going on at that point. So they're probably like,
time to go.
There's a lot of, I can slip out now, and that's probably what a lot
that's
of the
that's okay, because let's talk about Hyacinth. Others survived by chance. Elderly residents who were bedridden or too frail to attend the meeting were spared. One woman, Hyacinth Thrash, slept through the entire event, waking the next morning to find the settlement eerily silent and filled with bodies.
Okay, I want to be able to sleep that deeply.
Imagine that, though. You're passed out, you're asleep. You get up to, like, go get your morning breakfast rations, and there are just bodies everywhere.
You know what? This whole thing is so surreal. I believe it. Like, anybody else, you say that, you'd be like, bullshit, how could you sleep through that? But you know what? Who knows? Probably.
Jim Jones's sons, Stefan, Jim Jr., and Tim, were away in Georgetown with the Temple basketball team during the tragedy. Yes, they had a competitive basketball team. They learned of the events only after receiving word from the Guyanese authorities. Their survival spared them from the horrors of the pavilion, but left them grappling with immense guilt and loss.
Survivor's guilt.
I wonder if they were fanatical.
From what I remember, the three of them were not. They tried everything they could to stay away from it, and if I remember right, a lot of them, or some of them, changed their names and they just tried to disappear after all of this. By the time the deaths were complete, 918 people, including 276 children, had perished. The massacre remains one of the most significant tragedies in modern history, a stark reminder of the dangers of cult dynamics and authoritarian leadership. The news of Jonestown stunned the world. Images of bodies sprawled across the pavilion, many holding hands in death, became an enduring symbol of the tragedy. The scale of the loss and the involvement of children made it particularly harrowing, sparking widespread grief and outrage. The assassination of Leo Ryan at Port Kaituma airstrip added a political dimension to the tragedy. Ryan became the only U.S. congressman killed in the line of duty, and his sacrifice highlighted the dangers of confronting authoritarian groups. His death, along with those of the journalists and defectors who accompanied him, underscore the bravery of those who sought to expose the truth about Jonestown. The tragedy of Jonestown left lasting scars on survivors, the families of victims, and society at large. The events of November 18, 1978 have been extensively studied as a case of psychological manipulation, coercive control, and the devastating effects of cult dynamics. Those who escaped Jonestown or lost loved ones in the massacre have struggled with profound grief and survivor's guilt. Many have spent decades trying to reconcile their memories of the settlement with the horror of its final moments. Jonestown had become a cultural touchstone for discussions about the dangers of charismatic leadership, groupthink, and blind loyalty. Like we said before, the phrase "drinking the Kool-Aid" emerged as a metaphor for unquestioning obedience, though it trivializes the complex dynamics and suffering involved in the tragedy. The tragedy of November 18th, 1978 was the devastating culmination of years of manipulation, fear, and control. It serves as a stark reminder of the dangers posed by authoritarian leaders who exploit vulnerability and idealism for their own gain. The loss of 918 lives in Jonestown remains a haunting testament to the destructive power of unchecked charisma and the fragility of human trust. Now, the magnitude of Jonestown tragedy shocked the world. When Guyanese soldiers arrived at the settlement on November 19, 1978, they were met with an unimaginable scene. Over 900 bodies lying in and around the central pavilion, many clustered together in what appeared to be a final act of unity. The sheer scale of the massacre, including the deaths of 276 children, rendered the site an eerie and haunting reminder of what had transpired. The soldiers, unprepared for the devastation, were visibly shaken. The smell of death permeated the air, and the bodies were scattered in concentric circles around the poison vat. Many victims were still clutching one another in death, and the sight of infants and children among the dead was particularly heartbreaking. I believe there were some talks from the Guyanese that a lot of the soldiers went there, they saw it, they immediately ran into the jungle and just puked everywhere. I mean,
what are these guys have never seen anything like this.
Nope, not at this point. The Guyanese government worked with U.S. officials to document the scene. Photographs, recordings, and notes were collected as evidence, including the chilling death tape that captured Jim Jones's final speech. The tape became a critical piece of evidence in understanding the psychological manipulation and coercion that had taken place in the community. Recovering the bodies from Jonestown posed a logistical and ethical challenge. The remote location of the settlement, combined with a number of casualties, made the task arduous. The U.S. military coordinated a large-scale operation to recover and identify the remains. Soldiers and forensic specialists were flown to Guyana to assist in the effort. Helicopters were used to transport bodies from the jungle to the airship at Port Kaituma, where they were loaded onto cargo planes bound for Dover in Delaware, Dover Air Force Base.
Dover is the biggest air place for mortuary affairs in the military. Right. Am I correct with that?
I believe so.
Many victims carried little or no identification, complicating the process of confirming their identities. Autopsies revealed cyanide poisoning as the primary cause of death, though some victims were found to have gunshot wounds or needle marks, indicating they were either executed or forcibly poisoned. Relatives in the United States faced the painful process of identifying their loved ones and arranging for burials. So keep in mind with how many of this was. So typically, when you go to identify a body, you walk into a morgue, they pull out the drawer, open, and boom, because they know who it is, and you're just identifying. Well, they don't know who any of these people are, so from what I remember, they basically lined all 900 people up, like had them out in one of the bunkers. And had all of their faces exposed, and the people had to walk through and identify.
How would they do that with children? Because I'm assuming some of these people didn't even know that they're...
They wouldn't. But what they would be able to do is, at that point, you would identify the adult, and then you would DNA test.
Okay.
At that point. It would be hard. Plus, you would more than likely see characteristics. Plus... most of the children are going to be in the arms of the parents. So they would keep them together in the transportation and notated and all of that. in cases where families could not afford burial or where identification was impossible, many bodies were cremated. Over time, memorials were established in various locations to honor the victims, including a granite plaque at Evergreen Cemetery in Oakland, California. A small number of individuals survived the massacre, and their testimonies provided critical insights into the events leading up to November 18, 1978. These survivors faced immense psychological and social challenges as they tried to rebuild their lives. Some survivors fled into the jungle during the final moments of the massacre. They recounted the chaos and fear as residents were forced to drink the poison. Their stories highlighted the tension between loyalty to Jim Jones and the instinct to survive. Jim Jones's sons, Stefan, Jim Jr., and Tim, once again, were in Georgetown with the Temple's basketball team during the massacre. They learned the tragedy only after it had occurred. Their survival spared them from death, but left them grappling with profound guilt in the task of explaining their father's actions to the world. Some elderly residents who were too frail to attend the meeting in the pavilion survived by sheer circumstance. Others hid in dormitories or simply refused to comply, hoping to be overlooked. Their survival became a source of guilt as they questioned why they had been spared when so many others had perished. The Jonestown tragedy had far-reaching legal and political consequences, prompting investigations, lawsuits, and reforms aimed at preventing similar events in the future. The U.S. government launched multiple investigations into the People's Temple and Jim Jones's leadership. Authorities examined financial records, correspondence, and testimonies from defectors to piece together the organization's activities leading up to the massacre. Allegations of abuse, fraud, and coercion painted a damning picture of Jones's manipulation and authoritarian control. Relatives of the deceased filed lawsuits against the People's Temple and its leadership, seeking compensation for the loss of their loved ones. Some lawsuits also targeted the U.S. government, accusing it of failing to intervene despite numerous warnings about Jones's abusive practices.
And I believe also, at the aftermath of the airport massacre, they actually captured, I'm reading here, they captured one of the gunmen, Larry Layton. He's the only person who ever served time and was convicted for his involvement in the Jonestown massacre. The Guyanese tried to try him, but whatever reason, he said, I was brainwashed. And then they just deported him back to the U.S. And he was actually, they couldn't convict him for murder in Guyana, but they did get him for conspiracy and aiding and abetting for the murder of the congressman and everything. And he served in prison, but he was actually paroled in 2002, actually. He's the only person to ever have been held criminally responsible for what happened to Jonestown.
Nobody alive left.
I mean, technically speaking, he got convicted for killing the congressman or helping to kill the congressman. The actual suicide for the whole massacre and everything, he actually wasn't there, but I believe they actually found a written by, I'm not sure if this is his wife, Caroline Layton. They found her body with a suicide note. It said, like, I leave all my assets to the Communist Party of the USSR. They found quite a few of those last will and testaments.
The Jonestown massacre spurred increased public and governmental awareness of the dangers posed by cults and high control groups. Nonprofit organizations dedicated to cult education and recovery were established, and some states passed laws aimed at regulating religious and communal organizations. The event at Jonestown left an indelible mark on popular culture and collective memory. Over the decades, Jonestown had become a symbol of the dangers of blind faith, charismatic leadership, and the ideological extremism. The phrase, drinking the Kool-Aid, became a cultural shorthand for blind obedience or questioning loyalty. While often used flippantly, the phrase trivializes the suffering of the victims and overlooks the coercion and manipulation that led to their deaths. Tragedy has been the subject of numerous books, documentaries, films, and podcasts, such as Scarlet Tavern. Works such as Tim Reiterman's Raven, The Untold Story of Reverend Jim Jones and His People, and Stanley Nelson's documentary Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple have sought to provide nuanced and detailed accounts of the events. The scale of the tragedy, combined with the psychological and sociological dynamics at play, has kept Jonestown in the public consciousness. Scholars, journalists, and psychologists continue to study the events as a cautionary tale about the potential for manipulation and abuse in close communities. Many survivors of Jonestown have dedicated their lives to preventing similar tragedies. They work to raise awareness about the dangers of cults and authoritarian leaders, often sharing their personal stories to educate others. Survivors have spoken out about their experiences, participating in documentaries, interviews, and public speaking engagements. Their goal is to shed light on how individuals can be drawn into high control groups and to provide support for those seeking to leave such environments. For survivors and the families of victims, the path to healing has been long and difficult. Many continue to grapple with grief, guilt, and the trauma of their experiences. Support groups and counseling have played a vital role in helping them rebuild their lives. While Jones's death marked the end of his direct influence, his actions have continued to be scrutinized and condemned. He is remembered as a symbol of the dangers posed by charismatic but manipulative leaders who exploit their followers for personal gain. Some historians argue that Jones was a deeply committed socialist who genuinely believed in his vision of equality, while others see him as a manipulative opportunist who used ideology as a means of control. His actions at Jonestown have overshadowed any earlier contributions he may have made to civil rights or social justice.
I think he was more of a narcissistic asshole.
Mm-hmm.
The Jonestown Massacre remains a chilling example of how idealism can be weaponized by those in power. Serves as a warning about the dangers of unchecked authority, the vulnerability of marginalized individuals, and the importance of vigilance in safeguarding personal autonomy. The tragedy underscores the need for critical thinking, open dialogue, and the protection of individual freedoms. It has inspired efforts to educate the public about the warning signs of high control groups and the psychological mechanisms used by charismatic leaders. Ultimately, Jonestown is a story of lost lives, broken families, and shattered dreams. It is a reminder of the human cost of blind faith and the need to hold the leaders accountable for their actions. The aftermath of Jonestown was as complex and far-reaching as the tragedy itself. It left a legacy of grief and unanswered questions, but it also sparked important conversations about power, trust, and the resilience of the human spirit. The lessons of Jonestown continue to resonate, reminding us of the dangers of surrendering personal autonomy and the vital importance of critical thought and accountability. So, that is the end of Jonestown. And we move on from that.
John Leonard Orr.
To John Leonard Orr, the firefighter who decided to become a firebug.
Mm-hmm.
So, we want to thank everybody for listening and thank you for visiting the Scarlet Tavern. Please remember to return your glasses, push in your seat, and as always, tip the bard.